Richard Hatch meets David Jason.
This is BFBS,
the Forces Station.
Right.
He's in.
No, look, give us a pause.
He's not.
Hang on a second, Alex.
It's like a bloody comedy show here. Yeah?
Right, so he's in.
Wait a minute.
He's on the chair. We've got him on. He's got his tea.
Actually, the coffee's not too bad. Apart from my joking, it was.
Was it? Is it all right?
Oh, look. Oh, listen. Oh, it's like being professionals.
Okay.
Very good.
Is that right? Can you hear all right?
Yeah, absolutely.
We have comedy royalty and now official national treasure, Sir David Jason OBE, with us today. Thank you so much for coming into BFBS.
Well, it's lovely to be here again. I'm so glad that you offered this opportunity for me to say hello to you again, Richard. It's only about, 10 years?
10 years since you...
You must be getting desperate then.
And you didn't helicopter in today?
Well, I wouldn't be allowed, would I?
Why wouldn't you be allowed?
Because this is a sort of,
you'd probably
military sanctuary, this is, isn't it?
I think you could have probably come in by helicopter. That would have been so cool if you'd coptered in.
Yeah, it would have been, but I didn't think you didn't offer me the opportunity, to be honest.
I'm really annoyed that we hadn't made that happen then. I mean, it's hard enough to get you through the front gate, to be honest, but let alone helicopter in.
Would have been nice, yeah, but...
We saw each other a few weeks ago at my sister's, and you blankly refused to play the spoons, so don't worry, I've got a pair of spoons here, so later on... you can have another go. I'm joking. You're not going to have to do that. I just saw your face instantly regret coming into BFBS.
Exactly.
Can we talk about your national treasure status? It's now official. Tell us about being invited to the Queen's Jubilee celebrations, because that must have been a very proud moment for you.
Well, yeah, it was. It was one of those things that just comes out of the blue. And I thought... Why are you inviting me to the Queen's celebrations? And the stand, or the seats, rather, where we were to be positioned and sat, they said to me, Sir David, please come this way. And there were thousands of people, you know, and so I had to have a guide. And my wife and I were,
ushered along,
and people were going, oh, good morning, sir. And I'm going, oh, good morning.
I'm a national treasure, treasure.
Exactly. Make way, move, please, move. And anyway, we got shown to our seats that was right opposite Buckingham Palace.
Wow.
And it was sitting, they said, go down, sir, your seats are right in the front row. And I thought, I'm really doing well here.
Is it National Treasures down here at the front?
Yes, that's it. I'm sorry about that, everybody.
Budge up.
I'm sitting in the front. Well, that was all very well, but when I sat down, I realised that the barrier, which was made up of scaffold poles, was right across your eye line. So I sat there, and in order to see what was going on, I had to either crouch forward like this, you know, and get a bloody crick in my neck, or I had to try and peer over the top of this barrier. And so because I didn't want to make any fuss, my wife said to me, listen, why don't you move back where you can get your seat? I said, no, I'm perfectly right. Perfectly. I'll be all right here.
It's only 6 hours. It's only six hours.
Right, so I can see like this, all right. All things said and done, it was just...
Must have been absolutely incredible.
But the thing was, yes, it was. It was great, and it was such a wonderful experience. But the bit that got me in the end was...
I know what you're going to say here.
You're quite
and let
right.
me just set this up, because I watched it and I absolutely loved it. This is... We're talking, I think, about the same thing here. The People's Pageant, the procession. Down the Mall, you've got the dancing, you've got the costumes, you've got the acrobats... celebrating 70 years of creativity, diversity as a country and all the rest of it. And then...
The Trotter's Van. So you've got the gold coach, the one that the Queen travelled in to a coronation, And all of the lifeguards on their horses with their plumes all bouncing like this, and hundreds of people and horses and proud people and soldiers. And, oh, it was wonderful. And right in the middle is a trotter's van. I mean, how on earth, who thought of that?
Jumani. It was just, it was just a, what did you think when you saw that?
Oh, I just thought, oh, no.
You didn't, please. Though, did you? Yeah. Or did you?
But no, I did for a minute, and I then thought, well, I was so proud in a way that, that they thought the people who'd put it together, that what resonated through the Queen's reign was the trotters.
Yeah.
As part of the Queen's reign.
A billion people watched that. It's incredible, really, isn't it? Yeah, a billion people saw the trotter van coming down the mound.
Yes.
Richard Hatch meets David Jason.
BFBS, the Forces Station.
How are you feeling? Because I know you had a nasty bout of COVID, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that was... I got it really bad. And the story is that I'm the only person who had COVID who had carpet burns on his forehead and his nose.
Forehead? How did you get carpet burns on your forehead?
I'm glad you asked me that, because what happened was that when you get COVID, that some of it attacks you very badly. It gets your muscles. And I was in bed, and I went to get out to the call of nature. And my muscles, which I didn't realise had sort of was so weak, I fell on the floor. And I couldn't get up. And I was near the bed. And, you know, I was trying to use the bed to help me
just
to
prop
stand
yourself up. Yeah.
Yep. And I couldn't. No matter what I did, the muscles wouldn't work. Neither my legs nor my arms. So I thought, well, what am I going to do? I have to call for my wife. If I could get to the door, because the door was closed, I might be able to reach up, open the door and shout for my wife. Well, the only way I could travel from the side of the bed to the door was, because the muscles wouldn't work, I had to use my head. And so what I was doing, I was like a caterpillar. I was going along, like, you know where the caterpillar goes?
Yeah.
I was using my very efficient head muscle and my nose to travel along the carpet to get to the door. And as I got to the door, as luck would have it, my wife just suddenly decided to make a visit, and she came in and found me on the floor, face down by the door, with unable to move. And so she was the one that helped me stand up. Anyway, we got me back to the bed. Well, a couple of days later, I got this incredible rash on my nose and my forehead. They were carpet burns.
Well, that's terrible. Anyway, it's nice to see you smiling. It's nice to see you better.
Yeah. So thank
that's
you.
Good.
Yeah. It was bad, but I'm here now, unfortunately, looking at you. But,
Richard Hatch meets David Jason.
BFBS. The Forces Station.
Only Fools and Horses will always be one of the greatest British sitcoms of all time. It's just a fact. What was it, and how do you sort of unpick the magic of what made the show so great? I mean, what do you think it was?
I think it's first and foremost is the creator was the writer, John Sullivan. Now, for some strange reason, John Sullivan had this strange gift that not many people have about putting words together and creating characters. John had had a little bit of success with a thing called Citizen Smith that was on television before Fools and Horses. And so he'd got a bit of experience. But the point of the story is that he was not a brilliantly educated man. He came from the same background as I did, which was secondary modern education, which was good, but it wasn't like, you know, Cambridge and Oxbridge and all of that, which you would expect people who go to those places are wordsmiths. They're pretty clever with English. And so he was the main a starter for it. Then you've got to put the producer, director, and put together the cast. And that was another...
That's the genius, isn't it?
I think that's part of
that's part of the magic, isn't it? It's got to be. Because when you go through everyone, you go, they could not have picked anyone better for any of those parts. And it grew, didn't it? It changed and morphed as a show. It started, didn't it, initially with just this sort of nuclear family, and then it grew to this, you know, the whole cast, the ensemble, didn't it?
Yeah. Well, John had done, of course, that he'd used as his inspiration his history from where he came from, which was Peckham, the South London. And so all of the characters are based on people that he actually knew. So he knew all of these plonkers, if you like. And putting those together. And as you said, the growth of the thing was that we were all learning as well. One of the good things that was great about it was that everybody was prepared to learn. So in other words, John the writer, me, the actors, Nick Lyndhurst, and all of the other actors, we grew, and John Sullivan was able to see the way that we were going with the characters, and he was able to write more and more specifically.
With you in mind, almost.
Exactly. Yeah. And that is one of the special things about it, is that he began to write for the strengths that his actors had got, and he recognised that.
Where did Dale come from?
Well, one of the stories that when, which is true, that when I went for the reading and I got the part, we had a sort of little celebration, if you like, with Nick Lyndhurst and Leonard Pierce, and we had a lunch to celebrate the start of the series, as it were. And so I asked John, and I said to John, what was in your mind? I said, how do you visualise Derek Trotter, Del Boy? And he said, that I met this guy who was down the market, he said, and he had a flat cap, and he was very, you know, outrageously cockney, and he had a big beer gut. So I thought, oh, that's not the way that I see it. So he said, how do you see Deborah? He said, do you know what? When I was an electrician, I said that I worked in the East End, Bethnal Green and all around there. And there was a guy there, we worked for, my partner and I, as electricians. And he had a building firm, and it was called Hockley and Sons. And Derek Hockney, he was this guy who I could not believe, because he had a cockney accent, which was like, you know, I mean, he talked like that all the time. All right, son? And he was as far out East End as you could get. But he dressed like the king. He was unbelievably smart. He was brilliant. Camel hair coat and a shirt and a tie, always absolutely perfect. Yeah. And I said, that is my inspiration, that I could see in the character, that the juxtaposition of this cockney fella.
Slightly coarse guy.
Yeah, who dressed immaculately, because it was counter to what people think of...
Of course.
...of wheeler dealers then. And so he said, I didn't see it like that, but if you're confident... I said, it's got to be, because it's a contradiction in terms. And that's, for me, is... And, of course, once we started that, and then John just took it, didn't he? He flew with it. There was a time when yuppies, it was.
Yes.
There was a yuppies. Now, yuppies, for those of you who are too young to remember yuppies, they were, you know, fellas who had the audacity to wear their braces outside their shirts, and they were the modern kings, as it were. They were the fashion
icons. Peacocks.
Thank you. Yeah. Yes.
Peacocks, weren't they?
So John brought that, because of the way that I'd interpreted the character. It was now Oh, yuppies! Let's do yuppies. We make Del a yuppie.
Where did the Monge too? Where did the sort of you know the wrong French phrases come from? That was another sort of masterstroke.
I think that John had originally put it in to one episode when we were, I think, supposed to be in Spain, but we actually shot it in Devon. That shows you the sort of money that we that the BBC was spreading about. We had this episode. Del, obviously being the sort of character he was always out with the trying to impress the ladies. Young ladies, yeah. As it were. And so the one that I think it was John's original concept was that in order to impress the girls, Del was at the bar, I remember. This very attractive lady comes along and he says, hello, how nice to see you. What's your name? And she said something like, oh, Barbara. You know, Barbara is one of my most favourite names. And she said, oh, really? Is it? Yeah. And she says something like, oh, where do you come from? Oh, well, you know, I come from London, but I'm an international man, you know. So he says, oh, I've travelled a lot. Oh, yeah, Monge too. You know, so Monge too was John putting it. It was the idea that if you want to impress a girl, you just threw in some foreign languages.
Something makes you slightly cosmopolitan.
Yes, you know, in command, a world traveller. And so he didn't know what he was saying. So from that, it grew. And I remember I went to France for the weekend with some friends. And I was in this hotel and not being very, very, very unworldly person as I was, and we came down for breakfast, and I said to these friends of mine, I said, what on earth is this thing they've got in the bathroom? And it says bonnet de douche.
Is that where that came from?
Yeah. They said, what on earth is that? They said, well, it's a shower cap. You put it on. I said, I can't believe this. So when we went to the next, we started rehearsing again for Fools and Horses. I said to John, I saw this thing in France. I said, we got to use it. He said, what I told him. And he said, yeah, right, OK, we'll put that in. So that part came another one of Del's famous chat-up lines.
Ladies and gentlemen. Richard Hatch meets David Jason.
This is BFBS, the Forces Station.
You've got a new Christmas book out, another memoir. It's called The 12 Dells of Christmas. How did that come about? And what did you want to sort of say in it that you perhaps hadn't said in previous memoirs?
The thing about it was that I was asked by the publishers, would I like to write another book? If the money's all right, son, I'll do anything, you know what I mean? So I thought, well, I think I've said everything that I needed to say. And they said, well, no, the history of bits of your career. I said, they said, and the one that stands out the most, of course, is Fools and Horses. And there must be anecdotes and stories about Fools and Horses that you haven't told. And so I thought about it, and then I thought, yeah, okay. So what then happened was, in the construction of it, we went back to how it all started for me as an actor. So that was a kicking off point, and what it was going to see a film at Christmas called Scrooge. Alistair Sims' Scrooge, A Christmas Carol, it was. And to me, that was the first big movie that I'd ever seen that just, you know, knocked me sideways. And so I remembered that, and I thought, well, that's a starting point. So then from that, it was Christmases through the years and what it meant to me and what ones I remember. and the stories that are around all of that. So that's sort of how it came about.
So it's sort of Christmas is past almost. I loved reading all the stories. I like the story in the book where about how Boyce's laugh came about from John Sullivan. Will you just tell us that?
My story about that is that it's more related to John Challis, that John Challis was the actor who played Boyce, and his laugh, it was very particular to John Challis.
Yeah.
It wasn't really John's laugh, but he developed it, and it sort of became a false laugh that wasn't... That's it.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, you've got the part. We could do it again. So it was really down to John and John Challis who they worked that little thing up together. And it worked so well because it was about John's interpretation of the character,
yeah,
that it was false. It wasn't a real laugh. It wasn't about humour.
A mean laugh,
exactly,
almost.
And yeah, that was how good that John Challis and the other actors in Fools and Horses was, that it seems very odd on the surface, that sounds very odd, that laugh. Yes, it was, but you just put your finger on it in a way, is because it wasn't true. It was mirthless.
Yeah.
It wasn't genuine laughter.
Yeah.
But that was Boyce's character.
Yeah.
And so that was, it married so well into that sort of surly character that Boyce was.
Yeah. I love trying to pick out the magic in it. There's so many bits of magic in it. I can ask you about, you mention it quite often, this sort of Oxbridge sort of set in other memoirs as well, and you mentioned it in this one. It must have been, was it strange always dealing with people who'd been to Oxbridge or Cambridge? Was that funny, having to deal with those that type of class, perhaps? I don't know.
Yeah, it was really, because I've always felt a bit of a lucky an outsider, a guy that was, I've been so lucky. Meaning that I was an amateur actor and I was so lucky to be able to follow my passion by someone who believed in me and gave me my first break in the theatre. So after that, all of the people that I met when I got introduced, if you like, into television, that particularly the BBC, they all came from Oxbridge, Cambridge or Oxford, yeah, or any of those. And they were always, I always felt that they were so far above me.
Did you sort of feel like they were better than you then?
Yes.
Did you?
Yeah. And it was... There was always this huge gap between us, that they were the people that, they were real people, as you know, they knew what they were talking about, and we were just a bit of an actor type person, really.
But that's, isn't that funny, that stays with you for that length of time, though? You know, an education which doesn't last that long is something that's sort of wrapped up and you just carry around with you forever.
Yeah, yeah. And it just... That's the way that it was. I don't think that that's quite so true nowadays, but certainly at the BBC then, there was this... Listen, it was my feeling, because
yeah,
I came from such a humble background in my estimation, that I always thought that I wasn't really very good. I wasn't good enough. And so the gap between... me or my station, my class of person, and the people at the BBC was just huge, and would never be crossed, really.
You wrote the book at home. Tell us isn't there a little scary story about you writing the book?
Hey, yeah, now, you've got to be careful here because you're going to give away, you're asking me to give away some plots here. That would
we don't have to do that. We don't have to do this if you don't want to.
No, no, I will, because it shows that the range of the bits that the book consists of a lot of memoirs, a lot of memories, but also a lot of anecdotes and a lot of things that happened. And the story that you're referring to, I might as well tell you now that you've started.
You've ruined it.
You've ruined this joke. I'm sitting at this table that we have in the lounge, and not the lounge, it's just an extra bit of a kitchen, really, you know. But we posh people now call it the lounge.
Look how he's changed.
Exactly. We get affected by it all the time. Anyway, so I sit there and one end of the table, and it's a table that's got like chairs either side and a chair at each end.
Yeah.
So I sit at one end of the table, and that's where I sit, and I start writing, and that's where I write. So I do it longhand. I don't have the computer and all of that. I'm not computer literate, so I write longhand. So the house is very old. Bits of it go back to the Doomsday Book. Wow. In fact, it's written in the Doomsday Book. So it's got the classic examples of a very old building of being visited by ghosts. Dare I say that? So having that knowledge, I'm sitting there one day and everybody's there, so nobody in the house. My daughter's at university, my wife's gone out. So I'm writing away and I look up, and there at the other end of the table is a chair, and the chair moves. And I thought, good Lord, I'm seeing things. It can't move on its own. So I went back to writing. And I heard something, I looked up, and there was this chair again, it was moving. I thought, oh my God, this is getting serious now,
this
love.
This is it.
So I thought, I can't go back to writing, there's something going on. And the movement got slightly more and a bit louder. And I thought, wait a minute, hang about. And I bent down and looked under the table, and there was my dog, Tuffy, and she got in between the chair and she was trying to sleep. And as she was turning over, she was
banging the chair leg.
The chair leg.
I love it.
So that was the end of my ghost story, which you've now perfectly ruined.
That's the whole of chapter 10 gone.
Yeah. So don't bother to read chapter 10, people.
Just rip it out.
Richard Hatch meets David Jason.
BS.
The Forces Station.
Last time I saw you, you said you'd been in a helicopter with Tim Peake. And you said you were going to try and help me speak to Tim Peake. How are we getting on with that?
Oh, talk about Mr. Con Merchant. Trying to bend my arm.
How did that come about? How did you meet Tim Peake, the astronaut?
Tim Peake is part of a helicopter display team. And I was invited to go and have a look at them because we were going to get involved in their display for Fairford Air Show. Who should be one of the pilots of this display was Tim Peake. So I said, Tim, are you all right, pal? As you do, you know. And we went along to see this display, and he said to me, listen, you like helicopters. Would you like to come for a flight? You can come with me.
So, and so you were like, oh, hang on, do I? And then you're like, hang on, it's Tim Peake. This is going to be fine.
Yeah, I said, you will keep it within, the zone.
The atmosphere.
Yes, exactly. So he said, don't worry. So, yeah, he was an absolute charmer.
Yeah, he's very polite, isn't he? He's very...
he is. Very self-effacing.
Yeah.
Richard Hatch meets David Jason.
BFBS.
The Forces Station.
Are you ready for this? This is a sort of quick fire round, okay?
Yeah, go on.
Okay. So David Jason, OBE, bare nets on, quick fire questions. Who was the first girl you kissed?
Oh. Why? What do you mean? If I listen,
This is quick fire.
Yeah, no.
Quick fire.
I'm just thinking. If I mention this girl and she's... What will happen? She's married.
Come on.
All right, Jennifer Everest.
OK, where did you kiss her?
In the alleyway in near where I live.
OK. What do people shout at you in the street?
Wait, no, boy.
When was the last time you cried?
When last time I saw you.
Proudest moment?
Getting my knighthood.
What do you worry about?
Well, I suppose... I don't worry about anything. No, don't. Let's go there.
OK.
It's too long, too okay. complicated.
Who was the most talented person you ever worked with?
Ronnie Barker.
Have you ever stolen anything?
Stolen anything? Some gags off Ronnie Barker.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
OK. Name something that you are sick of.
Oh, God, there's so many. But I tell you...
Give us your top three.
All right, top three is... the top three is road signs that are on the side of the road that are left to grow over with foliage.
Not being used.
Yeah, so you can't see them.
Yeah. Yeah. Not tended.
Not tended.
Go on, that's one. Second one.
Second one is swearing on television.
OK, so that's your second one. Last thing you're sick of.
Yeah, I can't think. I'm so good, you see. I'm so nice. I don't have anything.
Was in a state of euphoria.
Yeah.
OK, last one then. What was the last thing you fixed?
Funnily enough, I was only fixed it yesterday. I finished it off with a set of steps that go up to my oil tank. Sorry, everybody, but we all got them. In order to see whether it was full or not. And I would cut in some stairs, some steps, with some old slabs that I got. And things like that.
And you went and did it. You went and fixed it.
I did it. I fixed it myself.
Perfect.
Go, go, go. Richard Hatch meets David Jason.
BFBS.
The Forces Station.
I know you have a very fond affection for the men and women who serve in our military. They'll be listening all over the Forces world. I just wanted to ask you about what remembrance means to you.
All of what our country went through and all of our military and what they did and those guys, because often say that they gave their lives for us. They didn't really give it. It was taken from them. But what they gave was they gave their commitment to the country to defend us against this lunatic who thought that he should own the world. And so... with all the people, the guys and girls who didn't come back, I think we owe a great deal to their memory, and we must never, ever lose it.
So, David Jason, OB, thank you so much for coming into BFBS.
Oh, it's my pleasure. That it? Listen, I've got tons of stories.
Ladies and gentlemen. Richard Hatch meets David Jason.
This is BFBS, the Forces Station.